Good evening. I'm Marcia Henry. I'm the director here at the Center for Women, Peace and Security, and very excited and happy to introduce this panel of speakers. Tonight we have, I'm supposed to confirm, I have these excellent briefing notes, which many people often ignore, but today I'm not going to ignore them because Zoe, who printed them up for me, is just sitting right here. And so I want to make sure I, for once, because I tweeted my chairing prowess, which was actually a bit of a joke because the last event went over by half an hour. This one will not go over by half an hour. So we're going to have this order of speaking, and we're going to have a kind of a bit more of a, I guess, a interactive kind of session today, where Jamie has kindly set out some questions for the panelists to sort of engage with and situate their own work within. And then after that, we'll open it up for conversation with the audience. So just confirming that the speakers have given permission for the event to be recorded, but we won't be recording the Q&A part of the event, so feel free to be as frank and open as you wish. And then we'll close at 8 o'clock. This event is part of the Center for Women, Peace and Security's seminar and event series. And this also is, a very nice follow-up from the second working paper series that we, working paper that we produced here from the center, which was by Jamie. And unfortunately, those copies, those hard copies, that's the one last copy that we have, are sold out. No, they were free, but they're out of print. But you can get them on the website. So if you visit the Center for Women, Peace and Security's web pages, you will see all of our working paper series available in PDF on online copies. So please do visit it and download happily. We have on my left Noor Abu Asab, who is the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Transnational Development and Collaboration, CTDC. Noor is a queer Palestinian feminist sociologist who was awarded a PhD in sociology in 2012 from the University of Warwick. Noor has a number of publications around identities, sexualities, migration, post-colonialism, and methods of decolonizing, and has a forthcoming book in the making under the title Queering Ethnicities and Nationalisms. Jamie J. Hagen is the James N. Rosenau Postdoctoral Fellow with the International Studies Association for 2018-2019, as well as an affiliated scholar with the Pembroke Center at Brown University. And she's also a visiting scholar here at the Center for Women, Peace and Security. She is interested in how sexual orientation and gender identity matter to peace and security practices, with a focus on the experiences of with a focus on the experiences of lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women. Thank you very much, Jamie, for initiating the idea for this event, and really looking forward to these ongoing conversations that we are hoping to have, also too on Thursday, where we have an event with students in the Department of Gender Studies looking further at these issues. Henry Mertinen is head of gender and peacebuilding at International Alert. Sorry, there's a little note in here that I've only just looked at. Please check this. and has published extensively. Sorry, Henry. And has published extensively on issues of gender, peace, and security, including co-editing the book Sexed Pistols: The Gendered Impacts of Small Arms and Light Weapons. Henry is a longtime friend of the center, and he's on the advisory board, and he's part of the new Gender Justice and Security Hub, that began here very recently in the center. And so I'm so excited to have this conversation between the three of you, amongst the three of you. So can we begin, please? Thank you.
Okay. Under the spot. I think the first question we said we will talk about is around... Okay, I'll read it. So, so the first question is about what community or communities do we have in mind when we say LGBT inclusion, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I think... I'll start basically with the problematizing the term itself, LGBT, and start by saying that actually there is a really significant major issue in research around LGBT people, which relates a lot to the way people themselves define themselves. People define themselves. And I say that based on research we carried out with Grindr and Mosaic. That was specifically, it was a questionnaire that was rolled out across the Arabic-speaking countries, all Arabic-speaking countries, and it generated 1,800 completed questionnaires. And one of the major findings, actually, is the major finding of this research is that people struggle to define themselves within the LGBT boxes. And we are talking about Grindr users who are men, who are mostly men who have sex with men. And this, in relation to quantitative data, this can be considered a major error in findings. And with this major error, there is also a lurking factor. The fact that the people we have access to are the same people who also have access to Grindr and not those who do not or those who fall between the lines. So when we talk about LGBT inclusion in general, what I personally have in mind and the conclusions we came up with at the center, we are not looking at a homogeneous community. We are actually looking at a community that where there are a lot of disparities exist. The people who identify generally with the LGBT letter are people who have... if I may say, differential class backgrounds or privileged class backgrounds. And I don't mean necessarily economically privileged, but also who have access to cultural capital that is promoted through language generated by the West around non-normative people or people with non-normative genders and sexualities. So yeah. I think, problematizing the term is important before we get into any other conversation. I have more to say, but I don't want to...
Maybe we can both speak. And
yes,
then
let's do that.
So I ended up, when I wrote this working paper, going with sexual orientation and gender identity, although the international affairs piece I've written about this has queering in the title, right? So I think all three of us will complicate and can speak to, depending on which audience you're writing for, why you might choose to use sexual orientation and gender identity or LGBTQ or queer. So when I'm, especially in the policy and practitioner space, using sexual orientation and gender identity, I'm really wanting to trouble heteronormative assumptions. And I think that reminding people that not everyone is straight by reminding people that everyone has a sexual orientation and a gender identity, this is one way to interrupt some of the underlying assumptions. And this is certainly necessary to, I think, the larger project of a gender analysis, because gender isn't actually just about women. And I think a reminder that queer women are part of this work, whether or not there's an intentionality around that. So I have found that raising a gender analysis that specifically looks at sexual orientation and gender identity is one way to reframe thinking about who women are in a Women, Peace, and Security project. And also resist the idea of holding up cisgender as the norm and recognizing that not everyone does identify with the gender they're assigned at birth. And really, finding talking about sexual orientation and gender identity is a way to resist thinking about gender as something that's actually about genitals, which I don't know that people would necessarily say they're doing, but I do think that comes through in policy sometimes, and instead remind people that it's about power and privilege and access and social norms and things of that nature. But at the same time, I also do like to use the words lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, recognizing that it does depend on which context you're talking about, and that framing the limits of these categories is really critical. But I think that in the using these words and having to have a conversation about the different types of vulnerabilities people have because of their sexual orientation and gender identity is one way. Unfortunately, I do think it tends to mostly be brought up in terms of vulnerabilities, but at the same time, I think it's important for bridging the work that queer organizations have been doing that is actually peace-building work that may not be currently thought of as women peace and security work. We already talked. There's also the issue of translation, which I think we can talk about more, and the travel of the word queer, the travel of the category LGBTQ, which actually LGBTQ is an abbreviation and isn't an identity. And so I don't know how many headlines you've seen where it's, you know, LGBTQ actor. Well, what does that actually mean? You know, is the person bisexual? What is their identity? So we're at a place where in the cases where sexual orientation and gender identity does get included, it often gets an LGBTQ like lumping. So I think that there's a need to untangle that a bit. But I also really like talking about sexual orientation and gender identity as a way to keep gender complex, because I do think there's a tendency, either moving from an academic space into a policy space, to say that gender is too complicated. And I wanted to actually quote from the toolkit that you were one of the authors on, Trainings on Gender, Sexuality, and the Body. You have this fantastic quote that says, never underestimate your audience's ability to grasp complex ideas, and remember that the most complex ideas can be conveyed using the simplest of words. So I think we're kind of in a moment where there's a real resistance in some international women's rights spaces to talk about LGBTQ people, to talk about sexual orientation and gender identity, because maybe it's too complicated or there's too much risk with that, when the reality is queer people are living their lives, and if we need to find less complicated ways to talk about it, then that's something that we need to do. But arguing that it's too complex, it's not really an option. So these are some of the challenges and things I'm thinking through when I'm deciding in different spaces whether or not to use queer, LGBTQ, or sexual orientation and gender identity, which we have, I believe, at least one email thread with one of the chapters that we worked on going on about. It's kind of, it's a shifting challenge, I would say.
I think sort of echoing sort of points that both of you have made, I think we are in a moment where there are different kinds of push-pull fact, sort of echo there. New possibilities that weren't there previously to work on diverse SOGI issues, on LGBTQ issues, but then there's also massive backlash. On the one hand, from kind of there's this broad backlash against anything to do with gender ideology, from kind of the far right, but also from various conservative parts of all major world religions, but then also resistance to LGBTI issues being brought onto the table from also feminist and women's rights organizations. But at the same time, you also then have these openings where you have a whole range of actors who haven't really thought through what LGBTIQ diverse SOGI issues might be, who are sympathetic to working on it, let's say foreign ministries or UN agencies to an extent. And I think that's where I see a lot of confusion amongst these sympathetic actors who do want to do something. They want to do the right thing, but they don't quite know what that is. And LGBTIQ the LGBTI community is seen as homogenous. It's not seen as something that has very, very different needs. If, for example, thinking back to some of the research we were doing in Colombia, in the morning we would meet with lesbian and gay upper middle class lawyers in their 40s, 50s, of sort of European descent. Their positions of agency and vulnerability would be very, very different from the Afro-Colombian transgender sex workers who we'd meet in the afternoon. But then there is this tendency to lump everyone together as LGBTI, LGBTIQ. And sometimes you also then see these kinds of formulations of looking at the needs of men, women, girls, boys, and LGBTIQ persons, not realizing that in the men category, in the women category, in the boys category, in the girls category, you might have lesbians, gay, trans, bisexuals in there already, or queer people, but that's kind of seen as something that's separate to men, women, boys, and girls. And I think a lot of the focus has historically been, and a lot of the debate, policy debate, but also research has been dominated by a focus on the G, so on gay men. And that's then also reflected in some of the research methodologies that are used. For example, there was a Human Rights Watch report on LGBTI persons in Syria, where the author, a gay man, I think if I remember correctly, just said that, well, because of the patriarchal nature of Syria, we're not able to talk to anyone who's not a gay man. So no lesbians, no trans, no intersex, no bisexuals, which I think is frankly not true, because there are organizations who have done that research, Mosaic, for example. So I think there's a need to sort of kind of go beyond the focus on comparatively privileged gay men who do have the privilege also of being more or using the spaces that are there, which might be minimal, but are there, to a greater extent than lesbian women, for example, or trans persons. I think in the debate, what has also been invisibilized have been non-Western identities, and also, Noor, I think you've been doing some really interesting work around this as well, sort of there tends to be a Western focus on identity and not practice, mm-hmm. and that gets then also lost in yes. in the policy and the practice. Yeah.
Yeah. This is what I was going to add, actually, to the conversation. I realize that SOGI, or sexual orientation and gender identity, have become the mainstream now, but I think the framework itself is failing massively. It's failing massively in terms of reaching to the people that we need to reach, who are usually the ones excluded because of the SOGI framework. And it's also been failing in terms of, it's failing on two levels, the level of practice and also the level of theory. Because when we look at, for instance, I mean, the term SOGI itself, what we've noticed is it does recreate a new form of normativity within what is deemed as a non-normative practice, in a way. So this recreation of normativity manifests itself, for example, in the way the UNHCR deals with asylum requests. One of the stories that we came across doing research on refugees seeking asylum on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity is, I'll tell you the story, of two men who fell in love with each other. They come from a village in the north of Syria. They went to claim asylum from the UNHCR in Turkey, who turned them who asked them, "Are you gay?" They said, no, but we love each other. And then basically turned down the request to get access to protection and to get access to humanitarian support. And this is this is one of the major problems we're seeing in terms of practice in relation to the SOGI framework. And what we've also noticed is when we talk about sexual orientation and gender identity, we do create identities. We do create differential identities, because language creates our reality to a great extent, if I may say as well. And when with the creation of these identities, what we fail to see, for example, is the impact of we really fail to account for the intersectionality of class with gender, or the intersectionality of class with sexuality or sexual preference. We have developed an alternative framework to SOGI, and we called it SPGP, which basically addresses discrimination on the basis of sexual practice and gender performance, rather than seeing them as identities, seeing them as dynamic. Over the past few years, we have felt that this framework actually fits better, not just in areas of conflict. I mean, we've been trying to talk about it with queer groups in the UK, in Germany, in Switzerland as well, and it resonated with them. So I don't think that the SPGB framework works for the East versus the SOGI framework works for the West, for example. And when we talk about SPGP, I mean, if we think about discrimination against LGBT people or people who define themselves as LGBT, this discrimination is based on the practice, on their visibility. So, for example, hetero-passing lesbian woman would not face the same discrimination. A hetero woman who does not pass as hetero would. And this is the major issue that we need to be looking at, we feel, because by doing that, we reach to those who are not, who we do not usually reach using the SOGI framework.
I don't want to go down as being someone who's standing up for SOGI as a framework that I think is working. I think it's making headway around policy in terms of having any attention to this community, because I think part of that is because it's probably seen as less of a threat because it's actually not saying the words lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, bisexual. You know, I think that's, so there's that problem. The organizations that in the States, I see people who are doing this work that's actually about people who are more vulnerable and as mostly being labeled as queer organizing. That's what I normally see used. I actually don't know any organizations using SOGI as a framework in the States. I've seen scholarship around it, and I've certainly seen, I do think international human rights organizations tend to be gravitating towards that framing.
Yeah.
And there's that tension between what people think is necessary in order for it to be included. And then there's the what is actually resonating with people's experience and actually going to be getting at the real challenges that one would hope. And then there's also the framing that I'm seeing getting more traction too, which is gender and sexual minorities, which I think is meant to try to resist detaching the conversation around queer people from the way that patriarchy exists and who ends up being most vulnerable to that. So, but I really am not super psyched about minorities in the framing of looking at this. But maybe, I don't know, should we move on to the next?
Because do you want us... I know, I don't know where that's coming from.
Yeah, I think
it feels like we're in Stranger Things. maybe... But do you want to take that opportunity, Jamie, to start?
Sure.
Or do you want to go down?
Sure.
Yeah. Addressing the second question.
Oh, my goodness. The second question I was... interested in thinking through is what actually is the Women, Peace, and Security agenda and how do we think about that? And so I learned about Women, Peace, and Security from the side of civil society and working with the Global Network of Women Peace Builders and also Peace Women, a project of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So I came to the set of resolutions in the agenda from seeing civil society engagement, recognizing these resolutions and the infrastructure to support them on the national, regional, and international level. And then, because of my curiosity around some of these queer questions, ended up moving into the academic space, which I do think has used the Women, Peace, and Security resolutions to have much broader questions beyond certainly the resolutions. And I think it's been a space where there's been feminist security studies engagement with gender analysis. There's also been a critique of the militarization of the agenda. Much less of that critique I've seen end up in the civil society space, or at least on the international stage around it. I don't know. Maybe there is more of a resistance to it. I didn't see as much of this resistance in some of the spaces I was moving, possibly because it has been so successful to actually include gender perspective in a space that really does limit women's inclusion in peace and security at all. So I think on the one hand, there's really robust and necessary scholarship critiquing the architecture, and then there's people who are like, this was the first time women spoke at the Security Council, and states are reporting on this every year, and we're using this as an inroads to be able to be having like a conversation. And now, what does it mean that we might actually get to talk about LGBTQ issues, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women in this space? But so I'm thinking through the possibility of inclusion or critique from the side of practice, and thinking through what it means to that LGBTQ human rights or this attention to queer lives seems to be happening outside of women, peace, and security spaces, and what would it mean to more intentionally collaborate, and what does it mean that there's been, would it be a space to actually bring attention to queer lives in peace and security? I'm also curious about this because of the increasing attention to masculinities, recognizing that women also have masculinities, there are queer masculinities. So, and what would it mean to also think through femininities as you're thinking through gender and power dynamics and peace and security? So I do think a gender perspective that is accountable to queer communities and sees LGBTQ individuals, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women as part of the work they're doing is fundamentally very different. And in the work I've done, I do think that there's an opening and an interest in whether or not people necessarily feel an accountability toward this collaboration, I'm not sure, but I do think that people are interested. I think people are a bit at a loss as to what the responsibility or next step would be, but there does seem to be at least some opening or interest in it.
Sure, yeah, maybe picking up on sort of some of the openings and the interest. So a lot of my work over the past year or year and a half has been with a lot of these sort of sympathetic actors, shall we say, who do want to kind of broaden the way we look at peace and security, security sector reform, women peace and security, gender peace and security, with this more complex, broader angle that also takes diverse SOGI into account. But at the same time, then, as I mentioned earlier, then you have this pushback by other actors on anything that has to do with gender, and a lot of that is linked to an explicitly anti-LGBTI agenda. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, Brazil or the US in their foreign policies. And I think that's where sort of a lot of this, the language has gotten really interesting. So you have some unexpected actors saying, we're fine with LGBTI in the text, but not SOGI. Or the opposite, that we're fine with SOGI, but not LGBTI. And then others then pushing for this listening of women and men, boys and girls, and persons of diverse sexual orientations and gender identities, which I think can be helpful in the sense that it highlights that it's not just men and women, boys and girls, but then it does raise other problems. But that, I think, sort of thinking through the process that of trying to influence the latest UN Security Council Resolution 2467 in this respect. You had these various countries which were broadly in support of civil society bringing this onto the table, others strictly against it, and then trying to sort of find the right kind of a language and one formulation that was then suggested was all people regardless of their gender identity, which can make it, can take the sting out, so to say, but then also runs the risk of invisibilizing LGBTI concerns, diverse SOGI concerns, but that might be the price to pay to get that language in, to be able to work on these issues in the face of this kind of opposition. But in the end, none of the above made it in. Mm-hmm. But I think that's something to think about, like which language to use in which spaces to make these openings possible. I think sort of one of the things, Jamie, you mentioned there that I think is really, really important as well to think more about is the risk of militarizing or pinkwashing the military by bringing in sort of or celebrating the fact that, let's say, the UK armed forces are for the, I think, fifth year running Stonewall's most LGBTI-friendly employer in the country, and the military is participating in gay pride parades and so on. And I think there's a real risk there of, as broadly with the women, peace and security agenda as well, saying like, yay, it's fantastic, we have more women in uniform and more women flying fighter jets and dropping bombs on civilians. Is that really where we want to take the women, peace and security agenda? And is that really where we want to then see diverse sexual orientations and gender identities being celebrated? But I think one just a final third point, I think what I personally find interesting and what we're trying to look at in this research project that Marsha mentioned that's just kicking off here at the LSE Women, Peace and Security Center is also looking at how homophobia, biphobia, transphobia are such a potent mobilizing force across different ideologies, from far-left groups like Maoist guerrillas using that as a way of mobilizing, getting support of the people, to far-right groups, neo-Nazi groups, to extremists of all major world religions. So there's something there around homophobia, biphobia, transphobia that I think can help us understand these gendered fears that are being mobilized for militarization and for nationalism across the planet. I think that's something that hasn't really been looked at that much.
I think what I'd like to say is to get us back to the women, peace and security concepts themselves, maybe. And maybe just, I mean, think about why would a women, peace and security program exist in the first place? I mean, there is conflict in the world, so, and there is a lack of stability and lack of security. And men are dominant. So basically, it existed in opposition to hegemonic and dominant frameworks that are already at play in relation to conflict and security. And I think one of the major problems that we have been facing, and I'll talk from my experience and from the experience of working in the regions we work in, which are mostly Arabic-speaking countries. I think one of the major issues we've been facing with that is most programs which address women, peace, and security stop looking at the root cause of the problem and start compartmentalizing struggles. So, for example, if we want to look at Iraq, I mean, Iraq might be a really obvious case of instability caused by the West, the mess, the effect on women and on other groups, and not just LGBT, but also other minority groups. The root cause of that needs to be addressed rather than just compartmentalize struggles and say, now we want to work on women, but the conflict is remaining and sustaining. Or now we want to work on women, but at the same time, our governments are arming militants and are arming groups which kill women and kill people from non-normative genders and sexualities. And this has been a major issue also in relation to, I mean, we do talk about a backlash when we talk about LGBTQ identities, but this backlash also exists still when we talk about women projects or women-led projects. And the thing is, it's really good to be self-critical in relation to how we approach these issues and think that we have been collectively failing in terms of addressing the root causes of why women are marginalized, why LGBT people are marginalized, and diverting it to the women of Iraq or the queers of Iraq. So I think being able to resolve that on the level of discourse and the language we use would enable us to foresee a better future, and we have also been failing. I want to add because we have not been doing intersectionality right. I mean, Crenshaw, who will be here in 2 days, tomorrow.
Actually, she's here today.
Oh, really? So Crenshaw, who talked about intersectionality beyond identities, did warn us against what we are now witnessing in terms of compartmentalizing struggles. When the intersectionality framework emerged, it did not emerge, so we say, ah, look, gay people have a different experience from women, and thus we need to focus on gay people. Intersectionality urged us to look at the intersecting systems of oppression rather than the differential experiences people have. We know that my experience of the world is very different from my brother's experience of the world or from your experience of the world. But what matters here, if we want to address, if we really want to achieve justice and address inequality and discrimination, is we need to zoom out a bit and think about the bigger picture and what really needs to be addressed first before we get into the details of the topic. One of the things, one of the things, for example, that come to my mind in relation to that is the way LGBT work in the Middle East and North Africa has been happening, and because we are compartmentalizing, we are also discriminating in a way or another. And I'll tell you a story of we received a request once from from a woman from Mauritania, a request for emergency support because she had to flee her family and go to Egypt. We knew of a number of regional LGBT actors who do provide that emergency support and who explicitly said only if she says she's a lesbian, even though the woman had a woman partner as well. She had a female partner, but she did not necessarily call herself that. So this is why I think if we want to address inequality, if we want to really push for an intersectional agenda that pushes for justice, we need to zoom out and look at the broader picture. What are we fighting against? Do we want to end the conflict? Or do we just want to save women and gays? So this is a very important issue, and this is a huge part of why there has been a backlash in relation to gender and sexuality projects in the region, at least.
It's great. I think that actually links quite well onto the discussion, which I think is around the third question, which is around the benefits as well as risks of bridging these communities and of building lines of solidarity, which is what you're talking about, and about, you know, how do you forge solidarity in the context of both the complexities of conflict situations or insecurity or violence, at the same time, trying to base many of these practices in specific communities that have labels attached to them. So it would be great. Maybe Jamie, you could start with that and go to Henry, and then we come back to you and we'll to share some more experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do think, I mean, I appreciate all the points that have been made, and I think that part of my motivation in thinking about querying the agenda is thinking about remembering that this is a political project, and gender has often now really been depoliticized at the same time as it's being politicized. Like, it's seen as political. So if initiatives do not choose to take up that political project, it's a lose-lose. So the new Oxford Handbook on Women, Peace, and Security has a chapter on women, peace, and security and LGBTI rights. So as far as it goes in terms of institutionalizing the next step of what it might mean, right? Here's a quote from the introduction by Lisa Davis and Jessica Stern. A broader interpretation of gender builds coalitions across the women's and LGBTI movements, which amount to a larger movement committed to ending violence against individuals for defying traditional ascribed gender roles. This broader understanding within the Women, Peace, and Security framework also helps strengthen the concept of gender equality and underscores the need to address longstanding gender-based violence and discrimination in transnational justice and peace-building processes. So, but underneath all that, there is this, the silos are not, they're fabricated, Queer people have been part of this project from the beginning, whether or not they've opted to identify in such a way strategically, or whether maybe they didn't find it helpful to to identify in that way. And I think that there's a real possibility that queer organizations will say, no, thank you very much. I don't want to be part of Women, Peace, and Security. I don't really want to work with the state and peacekeeping forces when we've been criminalized. So I think that this presents, again, an insistence to actually pull back and have an intersectional, collaborative, accountable approach. And I think that what can happen is organizations can say it's too dangerous to do that, we can't do that. But at the same time, without the cisgender white women who are doing Women, Peace, and Security being the ones that are having this intersectional collaborative engagement, you really are just reproducing the same inequalities. I'll leave it at that. If you want to have it.
I think I sort of agree with the kind of the potential benefits there that you mentioned in that quote of building a broader coalition and bridging some of the gaps that are there and breaking down some of the silos. And it's not just sort of in academia or in civil society movements. It's also embedded in UN agencies and foreign ministries where women's empowerment, women, peace and security, they already sit in separate departments. And LGBTI rights, SOGI rights, are then with the human rights section or with the OHCHR, whereas Women, Peace and Security is with UN Women. And there's very, very little discussion between those actors. And so when we did a research project looking at LGBTI experiences of conflict and peace building and presented it at several different donor agencies in the UK, in Sweden, Ireland, oftentimes, that was the first time that the people working in the same ministry who were working on Women, Peace and Security met their people who were working on SOGI issues, because that's just, it's seen as two separate spheres. So I think it does allow for bridging some of these gaps and building that broader movement finding new allies for the kind of work that we do want to do. And I think it does allow also for a more radical questioning of how gender functions in creating power imbalances and the constructions of security and insecurity. But I think some of the risks, Noor, you already mentioned there, with not looking at root causes but just compartmentalizing. And as with Women, Peace and Security, or with engaging men in the gender, peace and security sphere, I think there is also a real risk of just adding LGBTIQ and stirring it's easy to do that, or comparatively easy to do that, without questioning the patriarchal structure, power structures, without questioning heteronormativity, class, mm-hmm. Militarization, and so on, and actually kind of stabilizing the system by saying, oh, isn't it wonderful, we've got fly the rainbow flag on the Ministry of Defense. So I think that there is a need to take that project a lot further, making it a lot more radical. But that said, it's different in different kinds of places. I also agree that we should see the work as being inherently political, but there are places where you're not able to say that because that is a death sentence. And the same kind of way that visibilizing LGBTI individuals, communities, groups, movements, and so on can be a fantastic thing, it can be a death sentence in many places. And I think there has to be sort of a also critical thinking, critical self-reflection amongst Global North actors, that we don't go in with this patronizing sense of, oh, you all have to be out and proud, because in some situations that is the last thing that you would want to do.
Yes. With this question, maybe I struggled a little bit, but I'll build on what you both said. Because when I think about bridging, when we approach it in terms of what Henry described as add and stir, the LGBT, like the way we added the stirred the woman into many other work across the world, are we really bridging communities, or are we singling out communities by forcing in a way some sort of collaboration, or by suggesting that collaboration is needed or required, or it should happen, etc. The other thing I want to say, and And again, I'm talking about my experience working in the countries we work in. So from my experience, I'll say it bluntly, LGBT activism is very corrupt. And it's very corrupt in ways that recreate economies of victimhood that actually revolve on getting funding for what they call LGBT projects and sustaining that funding throughout. And we are talking about people who get funding or the organizations who get the majority of funding that is being thrown into LGBT issues in the region are actually mostly dominated by upper middle class gay men. And with this domination, there also comes the upper middle class gay men also have access to other privileges and do not necessarily face the same discrimination people who come from impoverished backgrounds do. But we are still recreating a system that monopolizes on a victimhood identity of the LGBTQ community as if we're one, yet at the same time the resources remain in the hands of the few, the very few actually. And with that comes as well, and it is a real problem because what comes with that also an emphasis on the importance of visibility, and actually a push for the loud and proud gay culture in a region where this discourse doesn't necessarily resonate with people. Maybe people would rather be private about their lives, and they should have the right to say no. I don't want to be visible, and I want to practice my life without this visibility per se. And the other thing I want to say about LGBTQ, I don't know if I even want to call it organizing because it's actually just NGO work. In a way or another, because this is not political organizing, this is not movement building either. But another big problem is how can I put this diplomatically? just say it as it is. Yeah, and what I really want to say is when we see that NGOs are actually driven by people who come from upper middle classes, it makes us question their intentions. It also makes us question the conflict of interest that might exist because they're the ones getting the funding. How radical are they, or how invested are they in changing the lived reality of people who suffer, not just the upper middle class groups or groupies even.
So. And I mean, I think it's fair to say that that's a challenge within women, peace, and security more broadly. I mean, you still have which organizations get funded, which women get to speak, which, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I haven't heard people be so honest about the fact that
patriarchy, class,
and privilege perpetuate even in this NGO space, which is seen as being inherently good, right?
Yeah, exactly. I also want to add another thing on that. I mean, one of how can I say this? Bear with me. Looking for diplomatic words again. It's really frustrating, and I do rant about this the whole time because it does feel intentional. And in addition to playing around, like recreating patriarchy and recreating even normativities, like judging who can qualify as queer and who cannot qualify as queer, we also see a lot of, how can I say this without it being problematic, but most of the backlash against LGBT issues is coming from, that's the source of why it's happening. And many of these, I mean, I don't want to say many, but I'll give one example of an LGBT organization and how these organizations are being politicized big time. And one of the major LGBT organizations in the Middle East and North Africa, I say this because this is how the organization promotes this, but I'm critical of the terms Middle East and North Africa as well. Many of, they also associate themselves with political parties. Mm-hmm. And the example I'm giving is basically, for instance, in one interview with one of the directors of this organization, she explicitly stated that their allies in Lebanon are actually the Falanges who committed genocide against the Palestinians, who are the Christian extremists of Lebanon. And that is a huge problem that we cannot escape when we talk about bridging communities. Mm-hmm. What communities?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Yeah, I think that point about what communities is really important, and I think that what tends to happen is that there gets to be this like very short list of who are the international LGBTQ folks, mm-hmm. and then because there isn't a deep investment, long-term investment in actually investigating what communities are doing what work and long-term collaborative work, the short answer is to find the person who speaks English who's already gone to the CSW, and you have this like reoccurring very narrow representation of the issues at hand. And so to me, I do think a possible benefit of depending on what the engagement looks like is to invest in having a more complex understanding of who people in this community are rather than like the easy list of however, the very short list of who mm-hmm. gets to represent these communities. And also, I think, to your point, you need to... I think there's... being visible at a panel at CSW or being able to write the one report can't be the only way to be mm-hmm. part of the Women, Peace, and Security Project. I think that these indicators or these ways of understanding that women, peace, and security is happening are really problematic in certain spaces. I think they're really powerful tools in some spaces, but in others, I do think there needs to be a different way to envision what a collaborative approach with individuals in networked in different communities looks like. I'll just say that.
Yeah, thanks. So sort of latching on to that, I think there is sometimes also this kind of slightly patronizing assumption that LGBTIQ persons are politically progressive, mm-hmm. but sexual orientation and gender identity does not define one's political orientation, which is isn't really rocket science, but there is still that kind of assumption, I think, and then it may come as a shock that there's racism and Islamophobia in the LGBTI community, for example, and homonationalism in Western Europe. There's misogyny amongst gay men, or that there was really recommended Teresa Tulin's research on LGBTI ex-combatants in Colombia, where one of the trans women who had been with the right-wing paramilitaries herself is very, very outspoken against out and proud, too loud trans women, ruining it for everybody by being so disrespectful of Colombian society. So I think that there's a need to be much more open to have these debates around diversity within the LGBTI community, or if it even mm-hmm. is a community. And I had something else, but I forgot it.
Hopefully it will be, it will come back to you in the question and answer. If people don't mind, I would like to move to that. Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much for all your comments. And I would just add one thing for the next panel that maybe people might want to come to. I think something about also to which academic disciplines dominate the knowledge production of what constitutes women, peace, and security might also tell us something about where we hear about queer lives, where mm-hmm. we hear about queer theories, for example, and what disciplines or what subfields we don't draw on in those conversations. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the next panel that we're going to develop. But yes, I would like to please open it up for questions.